Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We have a special guest today, Matt Lewis from the Daily Beast. And those of you who've been reading the Bulwark know that, Matt and I have had kind of a back and forth on this issue of the future of the Republican Party and whether or not we should burn it down. I say burn it down, and Matt says not so fast. So we're gonna have that discussion. Matt, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Hey, Charlie. Good to be here.
I was gonna play some Welcome to the Thunderdome theme music, but this is going to be a civil conversation, I think. And as I've said, I think you and I probably share the same, like 99.9% of our political DNA. Isn't that true?
I think so. And look, this is what I loved about, and this is what I miss about the blogosphere is, you used to be able to say like, hey, over at Hot Air, a la pundit says this. And here's why I think he's wrong.
Yeah.
And then a la pundit would counter, write something back, pointing out why he's right. And then Philip Klein over at the Washington Examiner weighs in. And we could have these debates, which I think were very healthy, without getting mad at each other. I think a healthy movement has disagreements and we can hash it out. But I think Twitter came along, and in my opinion, the medium is very important. Hmm. Twitter is bad, and I think podcasts are good.
Yeah, no, in part, Twitter is because Twitter, I would say, values snark over reasoned debate. And the moment you get to snark, then you roll your eyes and you go, okay, well, that's the end of good faith debate. Okay, before we get into this, though, I just want to take a moment. If we had an ongoing series, and I think maybe we ought to start an ongoing series that I would call something, We Are So Bleeped. I'm not going to use the bleeped word. We are really doomed. Listeners to the podcast may know the name Charlie Kirk, and there's a reason for that. In Trump world, in the right wing griftosphere, he is a major player. He's the head of an organization called Turning Point USA. He is, Donald Trump's BFF. I think Trump retweets him, on a regular basis, and he's a Trump loyalist. But he's the guy that 70-year-old millionaires around the country think is the future of the Republican Party. They think that Charlie Kirk is the guy who's going to bring around young people. No evidence that's actually happening. And there's been a lot of controversies about what TPUSA is really all about. But the reason I'm bringing up Charlie Kirk is because of his podcast, which is dated, I think, either yesterday or today. So this is new stuff. And he has, I would say, probably tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of young people who listen to him and take him seriously. We are not among that group who either listen to him or take him seriously. But this is what he devoted one of his rants to on his latest podcast, which again is listened to widely in right-wing Trumpian circles. Let's play it.
Do not force me to wear a mask. It's that simple. I'm not going to do it. I'm not. The only time I comply is on the airlines, because I actually need to fly the airlines to be able to do my job and travel the country so I can deliver truth to you and make an income and grow Turning Point USA. So that's the fight I do not fight. But every single time I go into one of these grocery stores, where's your mask? I say, well, first of all, the science around masks is very questionable. Very questionable.
Man.
In fact, some doctors think that masks actually make you sicker and have you less likely to be able to get oxygen and more likely to infect yourself and less likely to be able to fight the virus and actually more likely to be able to die sooner. A lot of people believe that. I've met many doctors that hold that view.
Many.
Secondly, we have a huge civil liberty issue here. Why do you have the authority to tell me what I can and cannot do with my body? I thought it was my body, my choice. I thought that was the entire thought process as to why we are wrongly able to terminate a million children in the womb every single year. And so I just don't like being told what to do generally by the federal government. I'm not a type of person who plays well when the government comes in and starts to say you must put this on your face. Now, I think there's some restrictions that I support. I'm actually in the minority. I support seatbelt laws because I think seatbelts actually save lives.
Minority.
And I actually think it's not that big of an infringement on your liberty. I kind of disagree with a lot of people on this. I mean, some super strict libertarians say, oh, no, seatbelts ever. Okay, if you fly through the window of a car because you didn't want to wear a seatbelt, and all of a sudden I have to pay for your health care, that's ridiculous. A mask might not even work. A mask is questionable at best. So the science around masks is needs to be debated more. And the fact that these Republican governors are like, oh, you must wear a mask, you must wear a mask, I think it's nonsense. I don't think it's popular. I have never met anyone that says, I just love wearing my mask. I love it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, okay, I am not a fan. I think it's dehumanizing. When I see a four-year-old wearing a mask, I can't think but help. We have let them down, and we have robbed them of their childhood.
We have robbed them of their childhood. You know, we could spend the whole podcast, Matt Lewis, just deconstructing all of that. The many, many doctors who have told Charlie Kirk that he has consulted with on this particular issue, how the science would suggest the mask will make you sicker. It's just, it's the just the stream of illogical bullshit out there that.
Yeah.
This is where I think we're doomed, because these people have platforms and people listen to them.
Yeah. No, you're right. Okay. Maybe there are some doctors, but I could find a doctor who says anything. I think the consensus is clearly that wearing a mask helps. The abortion analogy really falls down, breaks
it's
down.
It's terrible.
Right?
Yeah.
Because my opposition to abortion is premised under the assumption that that there are two lives at stake. And so similarly, you wear a mask to protect the other person. So here's the thing that really gets me, though, is like, even if you like kind of thought masks were bullshit and like it doesn't really matter, what is the harm? They act like, when he talks about how he is just almost like viscerally repulsed seeing a four-year-old wearing a mask, as if you're forcing them to wear, like, you know, take them the mark of the beast or something. Like, it's like you've humiliated them and stolen their childhood. Like, what is so
we make what is so them offensive wear about pants. Wearing a mask? Well, that's it. What is so offensive about wearing a mask? And I don't want to get too deep into this, but I don't recall this huge debate over, you know, no shoes, no shirt, no service, that sort of thing, or the other normal restrictions that we have to protect other people, the bans on, I don't know, spitting in restaurants. Yeah. I mean, things, there's all kinds of things out there. But what
and
also
yet he's forced seatbelt laws, which I right. think seatbelt laws are good, but logically speaking, I would rather, I mean, it would make more sense to be against seatbelt laws, right?
That's you. That's your own health. Yeah.
You assume the responsibility. You either wear them or you don't. But the mask is going to protect other people. And so I just think his logic breaks down. But fundamentally, the question is, why are we listening to him? He's probably, I'm sure he's a smart guy, but he has no wisdom. And I think a healthy society does not elevate young people who've never done anything to positions of where they're imparting their wisdom and advice. It's not healthy.
Yes, but in Idiocracy, these are the people yes. we listen to. And let's not pick on Charlie Kirk too much. I mean, there's a lot of this out there, and you know, part of the problem that we have is people will look at, you know, well, Donald Trump has now pivoted. He's got the new tone. He's wearing the mask. Well, this is still out there in the universe where you have millions of people who have decided that they picked up on the tribal cultural signal, they're not going to wear it. And of course, what Charlie Kirk says is trivial compared to what the president said. And you saw what happened last night. He goes on this late night Twitter binge, more than a dozen posts pushing all kinds of dubious claims. And he's retweeting a video from a woman saying that the drug was a cure for, you know, COVID-19 and that you don't need a mask. So, I mean, he is also promoting this Fauci critic named Lee Vallette, right, who claims that Fauci has misled the American people about many issues and all of this stuff. And he's tweeting this other crazy, I'm sorry, this Stella Emanuel MD, who thinks that disease is caused by sex with demons, which may be true, but
is this?
I mean, she believes in alien DNA, demon sperm, and all kinds of stuff, you know. So this is fun. Yeah, what could go wrong?
Is this the woman who wants to see our urine to make sure we're not secretly taking hydroxychloroquine?
Okay, well that's
I saw that on Twitter today.
See the part. So on a more serious level about why we're doomed, the exit of this, how we get out of all of this is when they announce that they have a vaccine, right? That we have a vaccine, that this is the answer. I think we're getting to a point where people have burned up so much of their credibility that when Donald Trump comes out on October 28th and says, we have a vaccine, I have discovered a vaccine, I don't know, 50% of the country is going to go, bullshit. I don't believe it. I don't know. Who do I believe?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Okay. Okay. So burning it all down. You want to do this?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, you write, Senate Republicans have enabled Trump's despicable behavior while doing nothing to mitigate his worst instincts. Rather than rising to the occasion, they instead buckled under pressure. They lacked both the courage and the character we should expect from our leaders. If Trump were a more competent authoritarian, their cowardice might have been lethal. But, Matt Lewis, you think we should vote for them anyway. Correct?
Well, let me frame it in the sort of the way that I'm viewing it, right? So like if an average person decided they wanted to vote for a Democrat for Senate, I wouldn't have had a column to write. The premise here is, you know, you've got this group, the Lincoln Project, that is taking millions of dollars and creating ads, you know, overtly calling on conservatives to vote for Democrats for the Senate. And I think part of the context here is also, you know, we live in a world where it seems very likely that Joe Biden is going to win decisively and that will deliver a message, I hope, about Trumpism, that will discredit Trumpism. And so I think ultimately the question is, do you want to hand Democrats not just the presidency, not just the House, which they already have, but also the U.S. Senate? Do you want to do it? So that, I just want to lay that out. That was basically my rationale for writing the piece.
Oh, well, I wrestled with this as well. I mean, this is a difficult question, especially for somebody who has been pushing back against progressive ideas for a long time. And so, when I wrote my piece in the Bulwark, you wrote yours in the Daily Beast, and I said, look, I mean, obviously, we know where the pro-Trumpers are going to come down on this. We know where the anti-anti-Trumpers are going to come down on this. You know, they're the ones who say, yes, the house is on fire, but they complain about the fire extinguishers. You and David French are a different story because you've been unwavering in your never Trumpism. And I gave you some love. You saw that.
I appreciate it.
Well, because you wrote the book, you know, Too Dumb to Fail back in pre-Trump, which really, you know, hammered the GOP for betraying so many of its principles. So I guess where I came back from this is that, you know, though, Matt, that this dysfunction in the Republican Party is not just Donald Trump, right? I mean, it goes deep. It is a pre-existing condition. So the question I had is, before you even approach this question of should you reward all of his enablers in the Senate with re-election, is what do you think Trumpism is? Is it just Donald Trump? Is it just a seasonal flu that when he's gone that we just move on? Or is it this cancer? I mean, so, and the mixed metaphors I threw out, you know, does the Republican Party need just an attitude adjustment or a complete exorcism, Botox or an enema? And I guess this is where I came down on all of this, that the problem is not just Donald Trump. It is this dysfunctional, dumbed down, corrupted Republican Party, which you described in your own book, and that you can't fix that by just beating Trump and then leaving his bootlickers in power.
Well, I certainly agree that this is not limited to Trump. I think Trump is a symptom of a pre-existing problem. And so that's, as you noted in my book, Too Dumb to Fail, it came out in January of 2016. And it basically warned against Trumpism. And obviously, the Republican Party did not take my advice. But I clearly would not have written a book about the dysfunction of the Republican Party that came out before Trump if I didn't agree with you that this is not limited to Trump. But look, the premise here is that something good will come from defeating Cory Gardner and Susan Collins. But these people are not Trumpians. I mean, they're basically moderates who I think did, sadly, do what politicians often do, which is attempt to survive. In this case, because the Republican base is a cult, they had to, I would say, enable Trumpism to a certain degree, but they're not Trumpian. And so the question is, what good comes from defeating them? I would say, you know, since they're not Trumpian, you're not actually purging Trumpism from the party if you get rid of them. I don't think it's really going to work to make an example out of Cory Gardner and Susan Collins. I think that defeating Donald Trump decisively is going to set that example. So really, to me, it really comes down to revenge. I'm not that much into revenge. I'm into moving the ball forward. I think burning things down is not a conservative instinct, by the way. It's certainly not a Burkean conservative instinct. And so ultimately, you're left with the fact that, like, politics is very messy. And if you're not going to purge Trumpism by defeating Cory Gardner, and if it's not really going to make a point that beating Trump isn't going to make, then the question is, like, look, we live in a fallen world. Politics is messy. What are you better off with? I would argue, as a conservative who believes in things like the right to life, having a check on the extremes of the Democratic Party and on the left is a healthy compromise, right?
There's a lot to be said for mixed government. By the way, I do think your strongest argument here is that defeating some of the moderate senators, like, for example, like Susan Collins or Cory Gardner, might actually leave the GOP more Trumpy than ever, because it still leaves, you know, Ted Cruz in place, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, all of those guys, right? So I do get that, you know. And so, you know, your caution is against destroying the party to save the party, that old thing. But I notice you keep mentioning Cory Gardner. What about Lindsey Graham or John Cornyn or Martha McSally or Tom Tillis or Mitch McConnell? Those folks who have beclowned themselves in so many ways. Would you vote for Lindsey Graham?
I would not. Okay. I would not. And I'm telling you, I mean, so again, I separate this sort of, there's a micro question. If I'm a voter in a given state, how do I vote? That's a different question than I sort of approach this a little more globally, in the sense of, you know, we have this very popular organization, the Lincoln Project, which has tens of millions of dollars and are now proactively, I mean, these are people who are ostensibly conservative Republicans. They mm-hmm. ostensibly, their goal, I would hope, is to restore Reaganism, you know, mm-hmm. or sort of a pre-Trump version of the Republican Party. And my question is just sort of questioning strategically if it okay. makes sense for them to overtly kind of go out of their way to target these Republicans and to flip the Senate, be the only check and balance on a Biden presidency. And I do think, you know, it's more, the problem with this is that the best or the most centrist Republicans are the most vulnerable. Like, the odds of beating Cory Gardner are better than the odds of beating Lindsey Graham. Yeah, and so I think that there's a weird, you know, problem okay, but, there but, that you could end up. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I admit in my column that I probably would vote for Ben Sasse in Nebraska. Now, you've acknowledged you would vote against Lindsey Graham. I mean, we could go down them. Martha McSally, who has turned herself into Donald Trump, or Tom Tillis, who I think was, you know, executed one of the most spineless things I've ever seen when he actually wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post saying that as a member of the Senate, he needed to uphold his constitutional duty to vote against Donald Trump's unconstitutional emergency, you know, power declaration to build the wall. And then he actually went around and praised himself for his own political courage and then flip-flopped and, as we all know, voted with Trump. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, person yeah. out there. But let me go back to, because you invoked Reagan a couple of times, and of course I have as well. You know, I've written similar things, but in your challenge to the Reagan to the Lincoln Project, you said, is it a smart strategy for conservatives who want to restore the party of Ronald Reagan and not empower the party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Okay, got to call you out on two things. Okay, number one, Do you, Matt Lewis, honestly believe that we are going to revivify zombie Reaganism? Is this ever going to be the party of Ronald Reagan? Isn't that pretty much done? We're not going back to Ronald Reagan.
Well, I mean, I would say two things. Like, first, I don't think we really should go back to Reagan. The best case scenario, I think, would be, you know, taking the good things about Reagan, including character, I would say, and applying them to our times. I mean, Reagan was never looking back. I mean, he was a Coolidge fan. He was also an FDR fan, but he was trying to lead us into the future, and he was tackling issues like incredibly high tax rates at the time, like the Soviet Union, which was a huge threat. I think what we would need to do is to apply, you know, kind of Reaganism to today. But will we do that? I think that's a long shot, actually. That's what I'm fighting for, but it doesn't look good, Charlie.
This is one of the reasons why I'm arguing for this full cleansing, this political hygiene, which is that we have to start over. We have to, you know, we're going to have to, you know, burst this, break the fever, you know, find a way through all of this, and then build something that's going to be very, very different. But the other point you made, and this is crucial, I think, to your argument, though, is that it's dangerous to give power to the Democrats, that Joe Biden's going to be in the presidency. It seems overwhelmingly likely that Nancy Pelosi will still be the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So then the open question becomes, what would happen if you had a Democratic Senate, right? Where they would have a clear shot to do a lot of things. And you mentioned that this would mean losing the Senate means Republicans would have little power to block a progressive pro-abortion Supreme Court nominee. Or push through the rest of his agenda, which I want to come back to. But you're also saying it would empower the party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And you saw what I wrote about this. Look, I mean, wait. If the Democrats were actually the party of AOC, Joe Biden wouldn't be its nominee. We'd be talking about Bernie Sanders. And the fact that we're not is not trivial. So that's kind of a straw man, isn't it? Because the Democratic Party is no more the party of AOC than the Republican Party is the party of Louis Gohmert, which, by the way, it sort of is in some ways, I guess. But, you know, it is the you made it the party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which I get how the Trump people are, you know, want to portray all Democrats as socialists. And there are socialists. There are people who make the hair on the back of my neck stand up. But the reality is that that's not who won the primary, and that's not who's on the ticket this year.
Yeah. I guess I would start off by saying that I just think, as a conservative, I am very skeptical of any burn it all down idea. Like, the notion that you can begin the world over again with a clean slate strikes me just philosophically. I feel like safer to muddle through to try to like evolve and improve. We live in a fallen world. Democrats are also going to be susceptible to some of the same opportunism and you know, sort of negative incentives.
I want to stick with this point, though. It's like,
I understand. I promise.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because this is the whole point, you don't blow yourself up. Okay. All right. Okay.
I promise I'm not dodging it. Okay. But just to sort of finish that up. So I feel this is just a philosophical thing, that I feel like if Trump is decisively defeated and Trumpism is a sign to the ash bin of history, instead of having a, you know, debathification, denotification, illustration, that I don't think Cory Gardner, if Marco Rubio, if George W. Bush is president, Cory Gardner is a compassionate conservative, right? So does he deserve a pat on the back for being heroic? He does not. But anyway, that's my point on that.
This, by the way, is one of your best points, is that basically a lot of these guys are just opportunists. And so they'll go whichever way, you know, the wind blows. So therefore, if the wind's blowing a different direction, they might be okay. Okay. I mean, they're not true believers.
My expectations for politicians may be lower than yours, too. Like,
I have very low.
I feel like Democrats are going to be susceptible to some of these same problems. And so I don't think that this is unique to, sadly, I don't think the problems are unique to this generation of Republican senator, generally speaking. I think that Ben Sasse is sort of spineless. I think he's a smart guy who did not rise to the occasion. But I think he's responding to incentives, which are politicians want to get reelected. Politicians want to do what their base wants them to do. And therefore, I think it's probably the challenge is to change the incentives. Now, the president's different. You may have to change presidents to set an example. Do we need, and plus, where does it end? What about the operatives? If we're going to take out the senators, I mean, we could start a de-Trumpification effort that would ban. I think the operatives, in many ways, are more complicit. Let me get to the AOC.
I'm here for that, by the way. Seriously, you asked in your column, like, well, how far does this go? I mean, does it extend to publications and operatives? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. If you're going to drain the swamp, drain the freaking swamp. If you want to get rid of Trumpism, go after Trumpism. And I guess this, I'm going to keep coming back to this point. Donald Trump is just a symptom. And I've said this before. Donald Trump, in many ways, doesn't bother me because the guy's living life. You know, he's a narcissist. He's you know, he has all of these things, and you know, all of, you know, a fraudster, a serial liar, etc. But he is what he is. The shocking thing of about our era has been the acquiescence, the submission, the surrender, the way the Republican Party made itself over, and showed itself willing to accept all of these things, willing to abandon all of its principles. And so, quite frankly, I think that the last 4 years has been a really, you know, revelation about how deep, how dumb, to use your term, the party has been. And so I guess I am more willing to say we do need to go back and look at those roots, look at all of those symptoms, look at all of the voices and the guardrails and the people that we trusted, and start to reevaluate. I trusted this person. Am I ever going to trust that person again? You know, this person claimed they were running as a constitutional conservative, and they obviously didn't give a damn about the Constitution. So I guess that is part of the thing.
But, no, I mean, actually, I actually agree with you.
I know you do. I mean, that's why I said, so, but okay, now you said you're going to get back to AOC.
Yeah,
I
guess if
it's a choice between Cory Gardner running America and AOC, I get your point, but it's not. It's really not, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. So let me say, first, I actually have been very impressed with the Democratic Party for nominating Joe Biden and the fact that Joe Biden has really been able to fend off the left, like the woke Twitter, up until this point. So let me give him some kudos there. And I've done that in my column, certainly. But even though Biden's a centrist in today's Democratic Party, and he seems to be like a decent, good person, we'll concede that. I mean, his stated positions, even today, would probably put him to the left of any modern Democratic president. Bernie Sanders said that he would be the most progressive president since FDR. The other point is we know that even the strongest president is going to have to delegate all sorts of responsibility and appoint all sorts of people. And my guess is almost all of these people are going to be to his left.
Yeah,
they're going to be trying to push him leftward. He's already been pushed leftward on, as you know, taxpayer funding of abortion, which he used to be pro-life. Then he got pushed, understandably, because you can't be a pro-life Democrat at the national level, to become pro-choice, and it was sort of like a safe, legal, and rare thing. Now he supports taxpayer funding of abortion. What kind of Supreme Court justices is he going to pick? Is he going to pick Supreme Court justices that are pro-abortion? And if so, is there going to be any Republican Party left fighting for me and the unborn to stop him? Like, wouldn't it be nice to have one branch, one branch of government serving as that check and balance? And that's kind of my argument.
Okay, no, and that's a powerful argument. And I ought to clarify my position on all of this, because what I've said is I think the house is on fire and I'll worry about the redecorating later. Okay. By which I mean, I think that we're faced with an existential challenge. We need to do something this year. And so there is a temporary alliance between guys like me, some never Trumpers, and Joe Biden, you know, but it is a temporary alliance. And I can certainly, it doesn't include a guarantee that I'm going to support his proposals. And I'm actually looking forward to having policy debates and being on the other side in this sort of Democratic debate. But your point, let's go on abortion, because this is going to be a tough issue for pro-lifers. And I think we need to, you know, seriously address this question. And because so much of what's been happening over the last few years has centered on the Supreme Court and how important it is to be on the Supreme Court. I have to tell you, number one, and I've been pro-life my whole adult life. You know, for 15 years, I was the master of ceremonies every year at the Wisconsin Right to Life Dinner. My credentials are pretty solid on all of this. But I have to tell you, number one, I don't think that we're going to see Roe versus Wade overturned by the Supreme Court. And this is where you and I will probably disagree. I'm not sure that we want to, because that would rip the country apart. And I'm not sure that ultimately the fight for life is going to be won politically or through court fiats. It's going to be won through the culture. And my long-term fear is that even though you're getting some pro-life victories, by associating the pro-life movement with Trumpism, there's a long-term price that you're going to pay. And that pro-lifers are going to find themselves in the wilderness, maybe not in the next 2 years, but over the next 20, 30, or 40 years, because of some of this. So I actually can make a pro-life cause, you know, reason for, we do not want to be married to Donald Trump or Trumpism.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I completely agree with that. I mean, in this scenario, of course, Trump is defeated.
Right. Which may not happen. I mean, that's where we're getting, you know, you and I both suffer from PTSD from 2016. So, right.
Yeah, I'm operating under the assumption.
Right.
That Trump is going to lose handily,
For the sake of this argument, yeah.
Yeah, but you never know. And let me just say, I mean, I've intentionally been invoking the abortion issue because I think that Trump is so bad on issues that are fundamentally moral issues that when I cite other things that bother me about a Biden administration, let's say tax rates or regulatory policy, it's easy to sort of make fun of them because they don't, as important as policy is, when you're comparing a life or death moral issue to tax policy, it's easy to mock. But I think, if you believe that the unborn child, you know, has a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then it does become a problematic, I would say, to support, politicians, and I'm not saying, and again, like we live in a messy world, Charlie. I'm not, you know, I totally understand people who've decided to prioritize the, let's say, if you believe that Donald Trump is an existential threat that would bring the downfall of the Republic, I would understand temporarily prioritizing.
Well, I do.
You've been clear that if, you know, that if Biden wins, you go back to being a conservative. I mean, there was this Greg Sargent piece in the Washington Post where John Weaver, who's a co-founder of the Lincoln Project, you know, said that he's prepared to vehemently oppose the GOP efforts to obstruct and stymie Biden's agenda. Like, what does that mean?
I was puzzled by that because we don't know what the Biden agenda is going to be. So I share your, like, you know, what, I mean, can we get through this election before we decide that we're going to support the whole agenda? Now, look, I do think there might be, there's a great piece in The Atlantic by Quinta Jurassic and Benjamin Wittes, who talks about the Never Trump movement and the possibility that there's going to be common ground on a lot of issues going forward, you know, maybe electoral reform, maybe, decency in government, the support for the rule of law, things like even criminal justice reform, there might be, but there are going to be areas where we're just simply not going to agree. And so I was a little surprised, because I don't think that being Never Trump and being completely disillusioned with the Republican Party and the conservative movement, which I am, means therefore that I'm going to become a progressive. Right. It means that I'm going to be more open minded about it. It means that I'm going to say, all right, these dogmas have discredited themselves. They're broken. And so we are going to be open to this consideration. But I was surprised by this. So and I think that this is the part of your case that, and again, we disagree. But I do think the point of divided government is important, because there, you know, one thing that I think that we've learned is that the all or nothing politics, that once you have you've won a temporary, you know, foothold, and therefore you're going to put through, you know, the maximum part of your agenda without necessarily compromising with the other side, doesn't work well. And it's one of the things that has contributed to just through ripping the fabric of society apart.
And if Biden wants to, it may be that Joe Biden wants to govern as a centrist. It's going to be easier for him to make that argument if he has to deal with at least one chamber of Congress that has a Republican majority. It may actually aid his effort if his goal is to be a uniter and to be conciliatory. I mean, you can imagine the pressure on him from the left is going to be, they're not going to have a lot of room, I think, for moderation if they control everything.
Well, yes, but I have a real hard time imagining Mitch McConnell at this point dealing in good faith, because I think that it's at some point we need to move back to actually governing as opposed to scoring points, as opposed to tribal, who has the bigger stick type thing. And I don't know how you do that without sort of breaking the power structure that we have right now, because, you know, compromise is not a terrible thing. Governing and solving problems should be the number one job of the federal government, as opposed to this sideshow. I mean, over the last 4 years, it almost does feel like governing has been like a distraction to your Twitter feed and the debates and the various, you know, sound bites that you make. And unfortunately, we're paying a huge price with the coronavirus here. So I do get your point. But I also think that if you look at the way the Senate, let's assume that the Democrats pick up 4 or 5 seats, they will control the Senate, but you will not have a radical progressive AOC type governing majority. There are a lot of centrist Democrats there. And I don't see them rushing to enact massively radical Green New Deals or defunding the police or imposing a 90% wealth tax. I don't see them doing that. And if they do, you and I will agree with one another in opposing them. But on the other hand, if they're actually trying to fix some of the stuff that's broken, I think the people of goodwill ought to support them.
Yeah, I think part of this comes down to my skepticism. So like, if I thought that it was possible or likely that, you know, that Never Trumpers could actually influence the Democratic Party and help moderate it and help it, moderate it. I would be all for that. Like, I think it would be awesome if the Lincoln Project, by virtue of helping defeat Donald Trump, as it looks they very well might, I mean, I think it would be awesome if that gave them a certain amount of leverage to go to Biden and the Democratic Party and say, like, hey, listen, you need to like play ball with us a little bit, because you needed us to win and you're going to need us again. I totally concede. I think Joe Biden, certainly temperamentally, seems like a nice, decent, good guy. He's not crazy. I think a lot of these Democrats running for Senate, I mean, think of Mark Kelly in Arizona.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish he was a Republican. Seems like a solid guy, certainly not a crazy leftist.
Voting for him is not burning it down, right? That's a reasonable choice.
I mean, he seems like a very serious, legitimate, qualified person to me. I think my concern is, and this may be just that I'm skeptical or negative, but it feels like the energy is on the left. It feels like, you know, if politics is downstream from culture, then the media and the squad and woke Twitter are eventually going to prevail. They're eventually going to take over the Democratic Party completely and push people to the left. I think that's going to happen. That's part of my fear and part of my calculus here. But if I'm, I would love to be proven wrong about that. And if I am, then things change dramatically.
Okay. I take your point here. Number one, and I think you had a really good column about, you know, are never Trumpers on a suicide mission, because I mean, what's going to happen? So if they win, they're going to be cast into outer darkness by Republicans forever, and the Democrats really aren't going to listen to them. And I actually agree with you. I think you're right on this. And by the way, I'm okay with that. I really am okay. You know, if the price of this is complete political being a complete political orphan for the rest of my life, I can live with that. Okay, so you're right. I don't anticipate that Joe Biden or the Democrats are going to be turning to never Trumpers for policy advice. But having said that, I think they will look at the coalition that elected them, and what they are going to look at is who are these suburban voters who delivered this to us. And I think you're seeing that. I think the lesson of 2018 was that if you run to the, you know, closer to the center, if you run the Abigail Spanbergers, you know, and the race and who was the congressman who won, Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, that's how you win control of the House of Representatives. Yeah, Twitter is going to be loud. The squad is going to be loud. But if you ran AOC in those 40, swing districts, the Democrats would have been annihilated. And they know that. So they know that, you know, at the end of this, they're going to look back at this election and think, what is it that we did that got women on our side? What is it that we got college educated people, even higher income people on our side? Why did the suburbs flip to us? And that is what I think is more likely than that they're going to have Rick Wilson on speed dial, you know, for policy advice. So I take your point on all of that.
So I worry, yeah. You know, and I do worry, and I don't watch Fox News. So this isn't like Fox News or Rush Limbaugh getting to me.
Oh, I know that.
But I do. I worry about the cancel culture. I worry about.
I do too.
The mob, both on Twitter and in the street, literally. And although Biden has not been hurt by it, partly because he is not endorsing it, they're his team. That's his side. And that's concerning to me.
Wait. What's his team?
Well, they may be, it's possible they will hurt him electorally, but this is the left, and the left has a lot of sway in the Democratic Party. And I think by and large, look, there's a version of cancel culture on the right as well, I'm sure. I'm concerned that the
Weekly Standard.
Yeah. Hello. I'm concerned that the excesses on the left are going to eventually exert pressure, and probably successfully in some cases, to any Democratic administration.
Well, yes. And this, by the way, is kind of the future. You know, a lot of us have thought, you know, center right, what is the future? I think part of it is going to have a coalition with center right, center left on these issues of the cancel culture of the extremists to say, listen, let's not lose our minds. And I think that's the reason why we're having the conversation that we're having now, as opposed to talking about what is a Bernie Sanders presidency going to look like. I do think that there's going to be opposition. So when you say, you know, well, that's their team, that's like saying, well, Hubert Humphrey is on the Che Guevara team. There are nuances here. Mm-hmm. And I think the real danger here, and I'd be interested in getting your reaction, if Joe Biden loses in November, if we're all wrong and Trump gets another 4 years, then in 2024, I can see a Democratic Party nominating an AOC. If there's anything that will destroy the center, it would be the defeat of Joe Biden, because you know that the Democrats would say, we tried centrism. We tried to reach out to the other side. Look what it got us. Let's go with our id. Let's go full on left. So it's either Biden in 2020 or it is Bernie / AOC in 2024.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's hard to game out how things play out. You probably wouldn't have thought Obama was going to be the nominee ever, but certainly not after John Kerry. So it's hard to game it out. But I think you're probably right. I mean, she would be eligible as well, barely. So, you know, sometimes in politics, winning is losing and losing is winning. It's hard to game out. But yeah, it doesn't bode well for centrism.
See, we think things are bad now. But when you and I are doing this podcast in 2024 and we're talking about the Don Jr. versus AOC presidential race. Okay. So, okay. We've litigated this long enough. You have a very interesting piece in the Daily Beast that I wanted to talk to you about. And it's something that's been rankling me, and some of our listeners might be a little bit annoyed by this, but look, I think that we have documented thoroughly all of the failures and the irresponsibility and the dishonesty of Donald Trump in dealing with the coronavirus. But I also think that you can hold two thoughts in your head at one time, which is that Donald Trump has failed as president, but also some of these Democratic governors have also blown it. And I think that there's been this, because of the tribalism, there's this feeling that, well, if we're going to focus on Trump, we can't also acknowledge that, you know, Andrew Cuomo did a terrible job. Bill de Blasio was a complete failure. And I do think that, I think it's time to at least look around at other failures. And again, none of this takes any responsibility off Trump. So you have a piece on the Democratic governors. Tell me about it.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, look, if you look at the New York Times, who, I mean, they do a great job putting together the data. If you look at these states that are surging, that have seen an uptick in COVID in the last 2 weeks, the majority of them are Democratic states. And then if you say, well, look, that doesn't matter, let's talk about death. Well, you know, it's unfair, but because New York and New Jersey are high density and they kind of got hit early on. But Democratic states are, I think, about double the number of deaths as Republican states. I mean, you wouldn't know that if you were following the news and hearing all the talk about, you know, Ron DeSantis in Florida and Georgia. And it's clear that Republicans have done a bad job, in my opinion, but Democrats have done pretty much as bad. I think that, Cuomo, I think, is someone, it's really egregious for Cuomo because he's been celebrated, man. He went on this late show victory lap. It's really unwarranted for him. This is someone who initially downplayed the virus in a major way. He also is one of the governors that ordered nursing homes to take coronavirus patients, which, you know, cost untold numbers of lives. By the way, yeah. Jake Tapper at CNN did a great job out.
Well, and gutsy, because, you know, his brother works there too. So.
Yeah. You think it's gutsy? How about me? How about me saying it?
No, exactly.
I don't have the Tapper credentials. I don't have my own show.
You don't have tenure.
I've got tenure. The other example that I think is Devin Nunes. I'm sorry, not Devin Nunes. I get my Californians confused. The governor of California,
Newsom.
Gavin Newsom, who was. Yeah. Although I'm always happy to blame Nunes as well.
Yeah.
Gavin Newsom really was praised early on this spring. I mean, this guy was heralded as kind of a hero. And then he opened up on May 9th. And it's been really a disaster ever since then. I mean, California is doing very, very badly. And this is someone who is a Democratic governor. He certainly knew better. That's the real danger, I think, is he took his foot off the pedal. But you can, again, just look at that New York Times thing. There's states like Delaware and North Carolina that are doing very poorly right now. Wisconsin, I think, is one of them. Louisiana is one of them. So I just think, you know, Democrats have probably not gotten their fair share of blame for their role in this. And in many cases, they've been praised, which I think is insane.
Well, I think, yeah, and I think that both sides ought to be aware of I should find, this is the difference between talking and writing. Have you noticed this, that when you write, you can actually be precise and go back when you're talking, because I was going to say both sides need to be aware of the blinders that they have on. I think it's a legitimate frustration of people who see the concern about the lack of social distancing at certain events. And then when there's a protest with which they agree, suddenly they don't have those qualms at all. And you have a lot of Americans. I saw one guy on Twitter today say, you know, I'm not allowed to sit with my father when he's having chemotherapy. And he's looking at a picture of, you know, thousands of people not wearing masks, not engaging in social distancing at a protest someplace. So people need to understand that that your tribal response to this actually enhances tribalism. That was half baked, I understand, but you know what I was getting at here? Mm-hmm. That people go
totally.
So speaking of mobs, because you famously got into some very entertaining fireworks on CNN because you insisted on using the word mob, and I was thinking of you this morning. Because I was on a show and they're showing pictures from Portland of burning flags and people shooting fireworks and, you know, pounding on gates with hockey sticks and everything. And it's like, look, this is a mob. This is an out of control mob. I mean, I find what the president is doing absolutely appalling, but I'm hoping that we can also hold two ideas in our head at one time, which is that, yes, there might be federal overreach and yes, it might be very, very, very troubling, but also there are violent anarchistic mobs who are engaging in riots. You know, why do people have such a hard time acknowledging that?
Yeah, it's really sad. And I think it speaks to the whole like Orwellian thought police, word police thing that we're engaged in. I think there's a sense that we don't want to say anything that would impugn the motives of people who, of course, are fighting against racism and police abuse, and we certainly don't want to do anything that might help Donald Trump. Charlie, just let me read you this tweet from ABC News. You might have seen this. Protesters in California set fire to a courthouse, damaged a police station, and assaulted officers after a peaceful demonstration intensified. Okay. That's George wow. Carlin, man.
Yeah, that's right. It got really intensified.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's well, I did hear one commentator say, and I'm kind of wondering about this, but I watch a lot of these the footage, which is giving Donald Trump exactly what he wants. I mean, he wants viral material, you know, about violence, and he is getting it. But do you notice how much of this violence seems to be coming from young white people? I mean, this used to be about George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, and it does feel as if it's been hijacked by somebody. So the people on the left who want to make this about police violence and Black Lives Matter, shouldn't they, you know, what is holding them back from saying, look, these idiots are undermining our cause. These are not our people. These are agent provocateurs. These are people hijacking our cause in order to pursue whatever sick, weird, violent agenda they have.
I mean, I did see a few months ago some viral videos where there were African-American protesters who did stop white leftists from like doing vandalism and saying, you know, we're going to get blamed for this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember those. Or when they caught them bringing in bricks into an area.
Yeah.
What the hell are you doing here?
But lately it hasn't happened. And you're right. If you watch this stuff happening in like Portland or Seattle, it tends to be young white men. They're probably like anarchists or, you know, I mean, I don't know how committed they are to the cause of civil rights, let's say, or criminal justice reform. And look, I mean, this has not hurt. Statistically speaking, you know, looking at the data, this has not hurt Joe Biden at all.
Yeah.
And that's possibly because, you know, he has distanced himself from this and possibly because Donald Trump is in charge. And so it's happening on his watch.
Oh, Joe is sleepy, though, right?
Right, right. But having said that, if I were on the left and I viewed Donald Trump as an existential threat and I thought we were 98 days away from deposing him, the last thing I would want to do is mess that up. And
yeah.
if you're trying to be creative and think of like, how could this get messed up for Democrats?
Yep.
You know, you've got a few tricks. You've got a wag the dog theory. You've got a vaccine that comes out tomorrow. Or you've got suburbanites getting spooked. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I this is just counterproductive, I think, even if you take away the moral problem that I have with, you know, destruction and vandalism and riots. This is just maybe not the smartest political move.
Oh, I completely agree with you. In fact, let's assume that our previous assumption is wrong and Donald Trump is reelected president on November 3rd and everybody tries to reverse engineer. Oh, my God. How did this happen? What went wrong? Well, right on the top of that list is going to be the reaction and backlash to the violence, I think, and the repulsion, repulsion against the rioting in the suburb. That's going to be there as one of the reasons. So, yeah, there's a very, very shrinking number of things that can go right for Donald Trump. This is at least a potential. So far, it hasn't really kicked in for him. But I've seen this before. They're investing a lot of resources into this. One of the reasons why his numbers are so down is the fact that he has lost about 12% of support among Republicans. If those people come home, these numbers are going to tighten rather dramatically, especially in the swing states. So you're right about this, at least, Matt Lewis. So thank you.
Well, this is, let me just say, Charlie, what a good, healthy discussion. And, we should have more of these.
I would love to have you back on, Matt Lewis. You can read his work at The Daily Beast. He's a contributor to CNN. And if you have never read his book, you really ought to. This was one of the most, the book that influenced me really very, very heavily over the last few years, Too Dumb to Fail. Thanks for coming on the podcast again. And thank you so much for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.